This is number three in a study devoted to law, the all-covering title of law. We've been looking in our last study about law rather in a general way. But now I want to come down to the law, which occupies so very much of the scriptures. And of course that law, in some respects, comes down basically to the Ten Commandments. We say the Ten Commandments, but basically they are the ten words. And they are known, as you know, as the Decalogue, which of course means the ten words. Our authority for this is Deuteronomy chapter 10 and verse 4. Deuteronomy chapter 10 and verse 4. It says, "And he wrote on the tables, according to the first writing, the Ten Commandments." Now, if you look in the margin, you'll see they put words. "The ten words which the Lord spake unto you in the mount, out of the midst of the fire, in the day of the assembly, and the Lord gave them unto me." The Decalogue, the ten words. Now, basically, those ten words formed for the people of Israel a covenant with the Lord. Now, we can read this if we go into Exodus and chapter 19. Exodus chapter 19. In verses 3 to 6. "And Moses went up unto God, and the Lord called unto him out of the mountain, saying, Thus shalt thou say to the house of Jacob, and tell the children of Israel, Ye have seen what I did unto the Egyptians, and how I bare you on eagle's wings, and brought you unto myself. Now therefore, if you will obey my voice indeed, and keep my covenant, then you shall be a peculiar treasure unto me above all people, for all the earth is mine, and you shall be unto me a kingdom of priests and an holy nation. These are the words which thou shalt speak unto the children of Israel." And then Moses takes these words back to the elders of the people, and they say, "All these things we will do." Then in the very next chapter, Exodus 20, are given the ten words which come directly from the mouth of God. We sometimes talk about the law of Moses. Of course, we mean the law of God given through Moses. That the ten words themselves, rather than all the many laws which were added on top of them, were the covenant, can be seen by a reference to Deuteronomy and chapter 4 this time. Deuteronomy chapter 4. We know, of course, that many other laws were given, but basically it was the ten words which formed the covenant. Deuteronomy 4, verse 12. "And the Lord spake unto you out of the midst of the fire. Ye heard the voice of the words, but saw no similitude, only you heard a voice. And he declared unto you his covenant, which he commanded you to perform, even ten words. And he wrote them upon two tables of stone." So whatever else the other laws meant, the ten words themselves form the covenant between God and his people, a conditional covenant. You'll notice that it was spoken to all the people. If you turn to Deuteronomy chapter 5, basically, this was given without mediation at first. In Deuteronomy 5 and verse 22, "These words the Lord spake unto all your assembly." He never spoke them to Moses and then Moses passed them on, but rather he spake them unto all your assembly in the mount, out of the midst of the fire, of the cloud and of the thick darkness, with a great voice. And he added no more, and he wrote them in two tables of stone, and delivered them unto me. Now, we must see what the reaction of this speaking of God to the people directly was. because I feel that in some senses the law need not have gone through a mediator had it not been for the weakness of the flesh. Now all the time we're told that the failure of the law was because of the weakness of the flesh, and I think somehow that the mediation of Moses came in for this very same reason. Let's read on a bit more. Verse 23, it came to pass, when you heard the voice out of the midst of the darkness, for the mountain did burn with fire, that you came near unto me, even all the heads of your tribes and your elders. And you said, behold, the Lord our God has showed us his glory and his greatness. And we have heard his voice out of the midst of the fire. We have seen this day that God doth talk with man, and he liveth. Now therefore, why should we die? For this great fire will consume us. If we hear the voice of the Lord our God any more, then we shall die. For who is there of all flesh that have heard the voice of the living God, speaking out of the midst of the fire, as we have and lived? Then they turned to Moses, go thou near, and hear all that the Lord our God shall say, and speak thou unto us all that the Lord our God shall speak unto thee, and we will hear it and do it. So the mediation of Moses then seems to come in after that the people could not stand the voice which was spoken to them. So this is an indication then of where the flesh comes into this. You'll see a similar thing in Exodus chapter 20. After the giving of the 10 words, in verses 18 and 19, it says that all the people saw the thunderings and the lightnings and the noise of the trumpet and the mountain smoking. And when the people saw it, they removed and stood afar off. And they said unto Moses, speak thou with us, and we will hear. But let not God speak with us, lest we die. So here again is the same point being made. Now we can see the comment of the writer to the Hebrews on this in Hebrews chapter 12. Hebrews chapter 12. He's comparing the two mountains, the mount to which they had come, and the mount to which this particular generation of the people of Israel that lived at the time of Moses, the mount to which they came. And he says in verse 18 of Hebrews 12, for you are not come unto the mount that might be touched, and that burned with fire, nor unto blackness and darkness and tempest, and the sound of a trumpet, and the voice of words, which voice they that heard entreated, or made excuse, that the word should not be spoken to them any more, for they could not endure that which was commanded. Now the next part of this verse needs some modification, because as it reads, it's rather difficult. Now if you omit the word and, you'll read the next part as though it is the commandment which they could not endure. So it reads like this, for they could not endure that which was commanded. Then this is that which was commanded. If so much as a beast touch the mountain, it shall be stoned. That's what they couldn't endure. They were frightened for their very lives. So there then is a commentary upon the weakness of the flesh with respect to the giving of the law of God. And it's interesting to note that at the first giving of the 10 words, they could not endure that which was commanded. In other words, it was something to do with the hearing. And then at the second giving of that law, when Moses came down the mount with the 2 tables of the covenant, we read that they could not bear to look on his face. And so he had to put a veil on his face whilst he spoke with them. So here then is a commentary, not just upon this particular generation of the people of Israel, but I think upon the commentary of the human heart in general. Because I feel that if we'd have been there, we might very well have failed in the very same way that this generation did. The hardness of the human heart. Now let's look at these 10 words more particularly. Back in chapter 20, of Exodus. In the history of the professing church, there have been various attempts to divide the 10 words into 2 halves. One suggestion, which was very popular at one time, was that they were divided into 3 and 7. Now, of course, we can't say with certainty how they were actually written on the 2 tables. Were there 5 on one and 5 on the other, or 4 on one and 6 on the other? Well, we just don't know. But as I say, various commentators and our so-called authorities have divided them up. One popular view was this 3 and 7 idea, and it was particularly popular because one could say that with the first 3, these 3 associated themselves with God, and of course they could bring in something that was very favourite at the time, the idea of the Trinity of God, with the number 3. And then the next 7 would represent the commandments which had particularly to do with man. Another idea was that they divided into 4 and 6. And if you look at this very carefully, you'll see that the first 4 do have very much to do with God, in his being, in his worship, in his name, and in the Sabbath day. And the next 6 have very much to do with man, the parents, and the neighbour. But the most ancient idea, and the one which seems to be the best, is that they were divided 5 and 5. And the Companion Bible suggests this division on the grounds of the words that are actually used. Let's just look quickly through these, and you'll see that the first 5 are characterised by the words, "The Lord thy God." Verse 2, "I am the Lord thy God." Verse 3, "Thou shalt have no other gods before me." Now there's the first commandment. The second commandment in verse 4, "Thou shalt not make unto thee any graven image." Verse 5, "Thou shalt not bow down thyself to them, nor serve them, for I, the Lord thy God." The second commandment. Now the third commandment, verse 7, "Thou shalt not take the name of the Lord thy God in vain." The fourth commandment, verse 8, "Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. 6 days shalt thou labour and do all thy work, but the 7th day is the Sabbath of the Lord thy God." The fifth commandment, verse 12, "Honour thy father and thy mother, that thy days may be long upon the land which the Lord thy God giveth thee." So the first 5 commandments are characterised by this expression, "the Lord thy God." Then the next 5 are characterised by the word "thou." Verse 13, the 6th commandment, "Thou shalt not kill." The 7th, "Thou shalt not commit adultery." The 8th, "Thou shalt not steal." The 9th, "Thou shalt not bear false witness." And the 10th, verse 17, "Thou shalt not covet." So here is then one division which seems to be in line, at least with the words of Scripture. And also this seems to be in line with the general idea about the commandments, for we know that the number 5 is the number grace. We generally do not associate the grace with law, but if you look at John's Gospel, chapter 1, you'll see that there is more than an indication that there was grace in the giving of the law. John's Gospel, chapter 1, and verse 15. "John bare witness of him and cried, saying, This was he of whom I spake. He that cometh after me is preferred before me, for he was before me. And of his fullness have all we received, and grace for grace." Now the word "for" is the Greek "anti," and it's translated in Matthew 2, verse 22, "in the room." The idea of one king reigning in the room of another. So if you put that in here, we have received grace in the room of grace. Then he explains the verse in verse 17. "For the law was given by Moses, but grace and truth," or perhaps better if it's a figure of speech, "true grace came by Jesus Christ." So the law then was possibly typical grace being given. So there was definitely grace in the giving of the law. And this all ties up with the idea of the division of the law into five and five. Now the Lord himself indicated such a division in Matthew 22. Matthew 22. Verse 36. When he's asked this question, Master, which is the great commandment in the law? Or perhaps, what constitutes the great commandment in the law? Jesus said unto him, and then he gives the great commandment, Thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart and with all thy soul and with all thy mind. This is the first and great commandment. And the second is like unto it. Thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. Now when you come back to Exodus 20, you'll see that it's almost certain that the last five commandments refer to the neighbor. Verse 13 of Exodus 20. Thou shalt not kill. Thou shalt not commit adultery. Let's go through these. First of all, thou shalt not kill. The touching of the neighbor's life. Thou shalt not commit adultery. The touching of the neighbor's wife. Thou shalt not steal. The touching of the neighbor's property. Thou shalt not bear false witness against thy neighbor. The touching of the neighbor's character. And then finally, coming back to the very thoughts of the person himself, thou shalt not covet anything that is thy neighbor. So the last five, at least, can be tied up with the second, or we won't call it the second, but the commandment that the Lord called, which was like unto the first, the neighbor commandment. So that certainly seems to give us some indication of the division. Now there's something else interesting about these Ten Commandments, and that is that they proceed from the highest to the lowest. They start from the very being of God, and they proceed right down to the very thoughts in the mind of the individual. Let's just see this quickly. The first commandment, in verse 3, thou shalt have no other gods before me, touches the very being of God. The being of God. And you remember that it said that he that cometh to God must first believe that God is. He must believe in the very being of God before you can get anywhere. So the first commandment then touches the being of God. The second commandment in verse 5, thou shalt not bow down thyself to them, that is the graven images, touches the worship of God. So you've come one step down from the being to the worship of God. Verse 7, the third commandment, touches the name of God. Thou shalt not take the name of the Lord thy God in vain. The fourth commandment in verse 10, the seventh day is the Sabbath of the Lord thy God, touches the day of God. So we're coming down then, the being, the worship, the name, and the day of God. Then the mind is taken away in some senses from God to the home. And now we come down to what might be called the next most important thing to God. Honor thy father and thy mother, the parents. It's only then that the mind is taken outward to the neighbor, and we've got the touching of the life, which is the most precious possession that the neighbor possesses. Then the wife, perhaps the second most precious possession of his. Then his property, the third. Then his character. Now you may not agree with this, but his character, the fourth. And finally it comes down to the very individual himself. It comes back to me and to the very thoughts that are going through my mind with respect to what belongs to somebody else. So it comes then from the highest to the lowest. And if you go back the other way, you'll see that the tenth commandment starts with me, and it proceeds through my neighbor to my parents, on through to God in his many aspects. Now I think we must look just very briefly at the ten words themselves. They are so wonderfully simple that it's very difficult to add very much to them. One can't explain what they mean because it's so obvious exactly what they do mean. And this is the wonderful thing about these ten words.
Verse 2 of Exodus 20.
I am the Lord thy God. Isn't it wonderful that he starts with these words? And you notice why he does. Because he is going to give the authority. This is the authority behind these. If he hadn't started with these, we might have thought perhaps that Moses gave them, that they were the best attempt that man could make. But here is the authority coming from God. I am the Lord thy God, which have brought thee out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage or of servants. Thou shalt have no other gods before me. Better, before my face. And it doesn't so much mean before me, but in addition to me, because this was the great sin. It wasn't that the people of Israel, when they fell into idolatry, so much as gave up Jehovah, gave up the worship of Jehovah, but they had other gods besides him. So it literally seems to mean, thou shalt have no other gods besides me, in addition to me. Verses 4 and 5. I think these two verses must be read together. Thou shalt not make unto thee any graven image. Verse 5. So as to bow down to them. Because you can take this, as the Jews did in later days, in a very finicky way, to say that all art and all sculpture should therefore be banned. But of course this verse is not teaching that. The two clauses must be read together. Thou shalt not make unto thee any graven image for the purposes of bowing down to them and serving to them. This is not a verse against sculpture, as I say. Verse 5, he gives the reason for this. Thou shalt not bow down thyself to them, nor serve them. For I, the Lord thy God, am a jealous God. Now, of course, I've had this verse thrown at me, as I no doubt many of you may have done. A jealous God? This is a word that only applies to human beings. Well, of course, apart from the fact that this is just a human word which has been applied to God in order that we might know something of his character. Apart from that, we must read it in its context. In what way is he a jealous God? Well, it goes on. It has told you already. Thou shalt not bow down thyself to them, nor serve them. He's a jealous God in this sense, that he will not have any other thing or any other person worshipped. And in that sense only is he a jealous God. He will not share the worship with anyone. Now, we know that in our calling, he's going to share a great many things with us. We know that we are seated with Christ in the heavenly places. We know that we share something of his glory, but we will never, as far as I can see, share anything of the worship that belongs to him. He's a jealous God in that particular sense. Let's look at Deuteronomy chapter 29, because this bears upon this passage. Deuteronomy 29. In verse 17, he's reminding them of what they have seen in the land of Egypt. You have seen their abominations and their idols, wood and stone, silver and gold, which were among them. Lest there should be any among you, man or woman, or family or tribe, whose heart turneth away this day from the Lord our God, to go and serve the gods of these nations. Lest there should be among you a root that beareth gall and wormwood. And it come to pass, when he heareth the words of this curse, that he bless himself in his heart, saying, I shall have peace, though I walk in the imagination of mine heart, to add drunkenness to thirst. The Lord will not spare him, that is, this one that hath turned to idolatry. But then the anger of the Lord and his jealousy shall smoke against that man, and all the curses that are written in this book shall lie upon him, and the Lord shall blot out his name from under heaven. You see the way that jealousy is again connected with idolatry, the worshipping of one other than Jehovah himself. And you'll notice the very strong words at the end of verse 20, shall blot out his name from under heaven. Now, if you've got a companion Bible, it's very interesting to notice the way that Dr. Bullinger has drawn attention in Appendix 99 of the line of kings and the way that certain kings which fell into idolatry have actually had their names blotted out from the genealogy which led to Christ. So here was the way that it was put into operation, even unto, as we're going to read, the third and the fourth generation. Appendix 99 of the Companion Bible. So then, coming back to Exodus chapter 20, he is a jealous God in this respect. Now let's notice what he does. Verse 5, thou shalt not bow down thyself to them, nor serve them, for I, the Lord thy God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers upon the children unto the third and fourth generation of those hating me. Somebody says this is very unjust. Very unjust, but it's a pity that the next verse has not quite been rendered correctly, because the construction in the Hebrew seems to indicate that it must be rendered in the same way as verse 5. Now verse 5 says, visiting the iniquity of the fathers upon the children unto the third and fourth generation of those hating me. Now the next verse tells you, of those loving me, and showing mercy unto thousands of them that love me. Not quite. And showing mercy unto the thousandth generation of those that love me. It's the generation that you see that has been supplied in italics in verse 5 that must be supplied also in verse 6. The thousandth generation of those loving me and keeping my commandments. Remember that verse in Romans, behold the goodness and the severity of God. Well, the severity has to do with the third and the fourth generation. But what about the goodness? It affects even one to the thousandth generation. So the goodness and the severity of God. Verse 7, the third commandment. Thou shalt not take the name of the Lord thy God in vain. Not so much emptiness here, but the idea of falsity. You'll see the word in verse 16 that is rendered false. Thou shalt not bear false witness against thy neighbour. And that commandment seems to be very much in line with taking the name of God in vain. Now the word is different in the Hebrew in Exodus 20, but in the parallel passage in Deuteronomy, the word is the same. So it's more the false swearing by the name of God that is here condemned. Not just vainness, but the falseness of the swearing. Thou shalt not take the name of thy God falsely. Verse 8, remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. 6 days shalt thou labour and do all thy work. Now I am assured by the commentators that that verse is imperative. It's imperative. And some people have taken this as so far as to say, well, if the Lord commanded them to keep the seventh day as a rest, he also commanded them in just the same way that they should work 6 days and not 5 days. Now we may not quite agree with this, because I suppose that most of us work 5 days, or perhaps even less than 5 days. But here, it's 6 days. Now, I'm not going to tell you that you should work 6 days, but isn't it a sad reflection upon things as they are today, that one of the big problems that is coming about because of leisure is, what are they going to do with all the spare time that they've got? One of the big problems. So, friends, 6 days, it says, shalt thou labour and do all thy work. Then it goes on, verse 10, but the seventh day is the Sabbath of the Lord thy God. We know, of course, that this commandment, as a commandment, does not apply to us. But as a principle, we must surely recognize that every one of us needs a certain amount of time that we should devote to the Lord our God, because he's our God as well as these people that are spoken about here. Even in the 70 years of the allotted span of man's life, you've got the idea of 60 years of work and 10 years of retirement. Well, we've even spoilt that now, and it's 65. But here is the idea behind it. So the seventh day then is the Sabbath of the Lord thy God. In it thou shalt not do any work. And then notice this wonderful touch here, not just the master of the house, but touching the daughter, the manservant, the maidservant, and then even going out into the field, the cattle, the stranger that is within thy gates. How very humane the laws of God are. Do you know that other lovely commandment? Thou shalt not muzzle the ox that treadeth out the corn. Aren't these commandments wonderfully humane? And then people say something about the bloodthirsty God of the Old Testament. Well, here it is. Not even the cattle are to work on the Sabbath. Then he said verse 11, and he gives the reason. And notice these first five commandments are also marked off by the fact that God gives a reason each time why you should keep this commandment. So he gives the reason here in verse 11. For in 6 days the Lord made heaven and earth. Now, I haven't got time to go into the other idea here, that the Lord did not make heaven and earth in 6 days, but that he showed to man the creation of heaven and earth in 6 days. Now, that is an idea, and it is possible to translate the word made by the word showed. But I can't say any more. In 6 days the Lord made heaven and earth, the sea and all that is in them is, and rested the seventh day. Wherefore, on account of this, the Lord blessed the seventh day and hallowed it. He separated it from the other days. Verse 12, the fifth commandment. Honour thy father and thy mother, that thy days may be long upon the land which the Lord thy God giveth thee. Now this word honour is a tremendous word. It comes from a root which means weighty. It means to regard your parents as weighty. That is of some great importance. And this is the terrible thing about today, that it's just the opposite to this. There is the turning away from the parents. There is no honour for parents in this present day. And you know, in that passage in 2 Timothy 3, where he talks about those being disobedient to parents, if you look at the structure of the words that are actually used there, you'll find the word which comes over against disobedience to parents is the word incontinent. And that word in the Greek means without government. And so what is the germ in the home, disobedient to parents, when they go out into the world, becomes anarchy, without law, without government. Well, now here we are guarded against this. Count your parents as of great importance. And then the wonderful promise. Paul picks this out in Ephesians, the first commandment with promise, that thy days may be long upon the land which the Lord thy God giveth thee. Of course, we must see the opposite of this. Another commandment was that whosoever curseth his father or mother shall be put to death. So there's the opposite of this commandment. Now the next commandments are self-explanatory. Thou shalt not kill. Thou shalt not commit adultery. Thou shalt not steal. Thou shalt not bear false witness against thy neighbour. And then thou shalt not covet anything that is thy neighbour's. Well, now this was the 10 words, the Decalogue, which was given as a covenant to the people of Israel. And this, sad to say, was the covenant which the Lord says they break. Well, now, what a sad thing if we left the story there. But when we read on in Jeremiah 31, we read that the Lord is one day, under the terms of a new covenant, a fresh covenant, going to write on the very hearts of that same people the laws of God. And then we know that they will keep his covenant. So they failed on the Decalogue, but one day, one generation of them is going to keep
the Decalogue, because the very laws of God are going to be written on their very heart.